It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point, WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msosie@wfyi.org, also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Kobe Slagle will be here hopefully in a little bit. Happy New Year, movie lovers, film lovers. Hope you're having a great holiday. Hope a relaxing week. It's been a kind of a slow week for us in the film world, but joining me in studio, he was here last week, and he's here again to, we're going to talk about the best and worst and other things of 2014, Nouveau's own Ed Johnsonot. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Okay. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and don't worry if you've heard us talk about our best and worst already. We'll find colorful new things to add this time.
That's right, because we're only allowed so much space on page and so much time on No Limits. So we'll
exactly.
Come up with new things. So, but yes, this week, nothing new in theaters. Go figure.
Well, there's this horror film.
Which one? Oh, no, that's right. The Women in Black 2.
Yeah.
Which opened, it did open, not starring
today.
Daniel Radcliffe, today.
Today, yeah.
But not screened for us.
Oddly enough.
So we're moving on. But yes, if you heard, you know, we were, Ed and I, as well as the Film Yap's Chris Lloyd, were on No Limits on the 23rd to talk about the best and worst of the year. So so now it's technically the end of the calendar year. We are now in 2015. I always tend to, me personally, I tend to wait until the very, very end, in fact, even days after, to do my best and worst of the year. We recorded No Limits, I know, on December 18th. The show came on December 23rd. And, of course, Ed's best and worst was in last week's issue of Nouveau. Ed, has your list changed at all since publication?
Yeah, if I thought about it, it probably has, but I haven't thought about it.
You know? See, this is the prep work we do here on HD2. So.
Well, it's just that... I would never make these lists if people weren't interested in reading them. So I make the one that I need.
Kind of obligated.
Yeah,
same
and
year.
Then after that, but I'm not one of those guys that spends the year bumping things back and forth and changing them. And
like Billboard?
Yeah, and some of my colleagues, actually, who might be hearing this and getting a little annoyed. But, you know, if they want to do that, good, more power.
Everybody, we all have our own process of doing these. So.
Sure.
And I always say... That, yeah, technically, you know, I guess, it's kind of an obligation at the end of the year to do it. But I always say, because we're Indianapolis, there are still some films we haven't reviewed yet, Selma, and others that that will trickle down into Indy, and it might alter. And if it does, I'll let you know. I tend to do, especially when it gets to around Academy Award time, I'll let you know if there's any changes to the list if you need that. But that's just kind of where we are in the state we live in and the state that we live in. So anyway, that being said, I guess, Ed, why don't you go through your tops, if you would, please.
Where do you want me to start?
Wherever you want. You're the guest.
All right. Let's do top five in reverse, I guess.
Sounds good.
Number five, Guardians of the Galaxy, because I like movies. And that's a really good movie,
You wanted a fun movie in your top 10?
It's terrifically fun.
It is a lot of fun. It made number 10 on my list. But yes, it's not all just heavy, heavy drama, stuff that's released at the end of the year. We can have fun. And this is a film, the power of a film is that it, months after seeing it, you're still thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Guardians of the Galaxy, that was my favorite film of the summer.
I saw it four times, and I'm getting the Blu-ray.
You saw it four times in the theater?
Yes.
You saw it with us. Did you? And you dragged others to it? You took your son?
I took my son, and the other two times were just me.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Critics never do this.
No.
We have things to do, so.
I know.
So that's a great sign, the fact that four times by a film critic in the theaters, so.
And I mean, you know, anyone who has complaints about the structure or about the standard Marvel things that were inserted, you know, you're all right, you know.
There's also a talking tree in it.
Yeah, the physics, too. I mean, I mean, there are a lot of mistakes in the film. I don't care. I didn't care then. I don't care now. I had a wonderful time.
Also a good sign. And I remember there's a thing that happens in films quite often that kind of bugs me, and it's a cliche now, of using oldies music as mm-hmm. a punchline. And they do it well in this.
Yeah.
The mixtape that the Chris Pratt character has from his childhood, they use a song right at the beginning, and you hear these throughout.
And, you know, let's take a minute to talk about the marketing of the film, which was brilliant.
Yes.
I mean, first, they've got characters that no one knows.
Right.
So they release commercials showing the clip where no one in the film knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, look, everyone's just like you. No one knows who these people are. So that's okay. We're going to meet them. And look, it's kind of fun that we don't know them. And then we heard pop songs, kind of the Ooga Ooga, Ooga Chucka pop song.
Hooked on a feeling. And,
yeah, we're hearing that, and it's like, that's pretty cool, too.
It's different, yep.
And, you know, and by using those really friendly old pop songs, they also helped pull us in. They talked all the way through about what underdogs the characters were and the film was. Even when the film was number one everywhere and making extraordinary amounts of money, people were still cheering it on like it was a little underdog. And that's just perfect marketing.
Yep, and I think, yeah, you didn't have to know any of the other Marvel characters. And
no.
we know that the comic book world will let you know, you know, if you need to know where these guys are. They're in way off on the fringe as far as, you know, characters in these series.
Yeah.
So, and I always said, I said it was a kind of a Marvel version of the Dirty Dozen or Ocean's 11, where you have this ragtag group of misfits that have to get together and get the job done. It just so happens that one is a fox and the other is a tree and the other is mm-hmm. a wrestler. Dave Bautista is really funny in this.
He's very good.
I'm sure somebody has created the finest acting performances by professional wrestlers. This is on there. And we have the girl from Avatar who's green instead of blue.
And Chris Pratt is Chris Pratt, you know.
Chris Pratt studied like every 80s smart aleck cop hero, anti-hero, whether it's Bruce Willis or Mel Gibson or somebody like that. But he has that kind of 80s smirk, smart aleck hero vibe about him, and it works really well.
But his natural sunniness, is that sun within him that just, it still came out. It affected the other characters. He was a good man underneath,
yes.
You know? Chris Pratt, the actor, being a good man, I think it touches all of his work. You know, and there's a life-affirming quality with this guy that affects what's around him. And I really like, that's part of why I've always been rooting for him. And if you don't watch Parks and Recreation, this guy's been doing screamingly funny things on there for 6 years. They're going into their seventh in a couple weeks, and you really need to catch it.
Mm-hmm. And he was kind of that guy, guy from Parks and Recreation. So he had obviously a really good 2014 between this and the Lego movie.
Lego movie and then filming Jurassic World for this next summer.
Right. So good for him because he's not cut from the movie star mold.
No,
and or from the factory, and so it's like seeing one of us.
And he made, you know, of course he did all the working out and the weight loss to get.
Well, sure.
But he talked about how his natural state is big, not that, you know, not cut.
Right.
And he also, you know, said that he felt an obligation to get to that ridiculous state that he got, super muscly, because he's a comic book guy and he knows what comic book fans expect.
Right.
And he said, I had to be the embodiment of one of those guys. And he did it. In just one more way, Chris Pratt knows what he's doing.
And he also delivered a joke about Jackson Pollock that we will quote to our dying day, yet we cannot bring up on the radio.
No.
So there is that.
Great line, though.
And, Jason Alexander, Bradley Cooper does a really fine Jason Alexander mm-hmm. impression. And two of Vin Diesel's best jobs are this and The Iron Giant. And Find Me Guilty.
Yep.
So kudos for him for the vocal work of Groot, because we are Groot.
And if you hear anyone say, and Groot only said, he only knows how to say three words, he says five words.
Yes.
Just so you know, he says five.
And he says them differently.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's not just what you say, but how you say it.
So mm-hmm.
What's number four on your list?
Life Itself, continuing the Sunny mold. This is the documentary based on Roger Ebert's life story that evolved into the story of Roger Ebert's final days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heartbreaking and difficult to watch and moving and funny and shocking, and it's just a remarkable piece of work.
And it's directed by Steve James, who was...
Who
did Hoop Dreams, Real Paradise, Stevie, and Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel championed Hoop Dreams,
yes,
20 years ago, and well-deserved. So the fact that, and this is a rarity, there's a couple of these films. Boyhood is another one, which we'll get to. It's not very often we get to say, I wish this film was longer.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be willing to spend more time with this subject. And Life Itself is a prime example of that. As Ed said, what was going to be kind of a bio documentary,
right,
becomes much more than that because of Ebert's last few months and him coming in and out of the hospital and still writing, even though he couldn't speak or eat. They don't pull any punches, and not just on the last few months, but his rivalry with Gene Siskel, his drinking habits, his running around habits in his younger days. You know, there was kind of a boys' club of Chicago writers, mm-hmm, of reporters back then, and they show all of this, and some of it I kind of knew, but the fact that the amount of material Roger and Chaz Ebert were willing to show and allow. There's a great moment because we've always heard about these. When Siskel and Ebert started going on The Tonight Show and they started being parodied in The Critic, you know, it kind of became a spoof of their old rivalry.
Right.
Well, there's a great outtake section of these two working on a promo, and they're constantly needling each other. And this was what it was like in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can go on YouTube and you find early reviews when they don't agree on something, it's something to watch.
It really is.
You don't get that much on TV anymore.
I remember a show where Siskel had given away the secret of the crying game.
Ooh.
And Ebert thought that was absolutely unethical. And, I mean, he tore at him right there on the air and kept right at it. You know, it was amazing.
So, yeah, I'm with you on Life Itself. Way more than you hope to. I say way more than anticipated, and I wanted a lot more out of it as well. So,
my really number three, Grand Budapest Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
This is Wes Anderson, who makes all the precious little shadow box films that annoyed the hell out of my friends. I've enjoyed most all of his work. This is one of his absolute best, and a big part of it is that Ralph Fiennes stars and gives maybe the best performance of his career.
I think I'm with you on that. First off, about Grand Budapest, I think this might be, because I know, yeah, I think Wes Anderson is a polarizing,
yeah,
figure. For film, people who really like his stuff or they really don't. And I get it, because there is kind of a dry, acerbic wit, and yes, the perfectly framed photos,
yeah,
of his shots, whether they are face on or from a ceiling shot. I get that. Royal Tenenbaums, Rushmore, all the others. I think this is a good starting point for folks that want to get into it. Maybe this and Rushmore, because it's Wes Anderson's version of the screwball comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's set in a fictional European country during a change of war. And of course, Ralph Fiennes, who thank God is allowed to do comedy. That's really a welcome piece of fresh air with him.
And he's so good at it because he doesn't try to be funny.
No, he's not. And by the way, it should be noted, Jim Simmons, I think Lou Harry also brought it up, because I had railed the fact that he's not allowed to do comedy. I was corrected. He was also hysterical in Bruges. But that's a different type of comedy.
But
prior to that, I think it was Made in Manhattan was the last comedy Ralph Fiennes was allowed to do, and that's not fair.
No.
But yeah, he's really funny as the guy, as the head of the hotel,
mm-hmm,
who makes sure everything is in order, even though he's doing things with the old ladies and trying to get a painting, and he's training a lobby boy. It's just a fun, physical, hysterical performance from Fiennes.
And everyone you've ever heard of makes a cameo appearance,
whether they know Wes Anderson or not. Yeah, this
right.
is like a third of the SAG is in this. Adrian Brody, Willem Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum,
Bill Murray,
Fisher Stevens,
Tilda Swinton.
It's a fun film. So if you've never seen a Wes Anderson film or you're hesitant, this might be the one to start with.
My number two film is Richard Linklater's Boyhood. This is the film that took 12 years to make because they filmed a little bit each year. They charted the growth of three people over a 12-year period. obviously the boy, there's a boy who's in the center of it. You watch him change from a child into a young man. And then it's also parents, Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke. And it's just, you know, he did it and he didn't make, he got it right. He got it all right. He understood that this kind of story, that the story was in the moments. It was in, not in big created drama. It was in, or a big arc. It was in the moments. And he lets us just flow down that river with them.
Richard Linklater made a film that has the look and feel of a documentary, but isn't.
Right.
And talk about a commitment. I mean, he's Linklater's work with Ethan Hawke, of course, on the Before trilogy with he and Julie Delpy. And, you know, we knew then that there was a sign of commitment of, you know, these three people were going to get together, what, every 7 years, 9 years, mm-hmm. and pick up where the story's left off with those two people and their lives. And this is an extended version of that. As Ed said, these are actors, one of which, the daughter is played by Linklater's daughter, actually yeah. real-life daughter. But, you know, they filmed, like, every couple of days, every year, you know, 2 or 3, 4 days, and that's how the story came. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes long. It could have been longer.
Easily.
And there is an arc of all of the characters. I mean, the son is the main focal point, but we see changes in the Patricia Arquette character, in the Ethan Hawke character, and we've seen these, where especially the Hawke character, who is the man-child, you know, the dad who wants to be cool and eventually becomes a little more sensible, but still has an old streak about him.
Mm-hmm.
And the young lad, one of the more natural performances. And this, none of this is movie
no.
family, movie teenager.
And you see him, you know, start off as your standard cute kid, and he grows up to be Peter Dinklage, only lanky.
Did you use that in a review?
No, I should have.
That's good. I like that. So, and your number one film?
Whiplash.
Yes.
You'll hear people. This is the ferocious battle between a teacher, a music teacher, and a student. The teacher wants greatness by any means necessary. The student is determined to get there too, but they clash in the way to do it. This could be a basketball coach and one of his students. This could be any number of relationships. It's a mentor and a mentee, you know, and. People have complained that it's unrealistic that the teacher would have lost his job right away. That, you know, on the day when the big finale happens, that it could never have happened in that fashion. Blah blah blah. Doesn't matter, because this is a film that gives you a realistic structure to begin with, and then just lets it fall to the wayside as it goes on, because you're focusing on this unbelievable rollicking or. Not rollicking, but this rattling wooden roller coaster ride of a relationship. And it's amazing.
It's, as Ed said, it's set in a New York music academy, and we have the young man who wants to be the drummer in the competitive jazz band, big band, and it's run by J.K. Simmons.
Schillinger from Oz, the father from Juno.
The guy from the insurance commercials.
You've seen him a million times. When you see him, you'll recognize him right away.
Classic that guy who's now, if you don't know his name by now, you should.
Yeah, he's going to win awards for the next 2 months.
But it is, and it's funny that you mentioned people complain that it's not realistic. I know certain football coaches and basketball coaches that wouldn't know what you're talking about, because this stuff still happens, but it's filmed more. Mm-hmm. But I would say, yeah, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you know, or if you want to go on YouTube and listen to the rants of jazz drummer Buddy Rich and how he treated his band, these happen. And this is a film that is at times a cautionary tale of, yeah, you don't need to be that great. You don't need to suffer this kind of abuse in order to be the very best. But at the same time, there are some people that, in this case for the kid, to grab a box of Band-Aids and just play the drums until your hands bleed, because that's what you need to do to be the very best.
Right.
So I think it's kind of picking your own tale of, do you want to go down that path, or thank God you don't have to go down that path. And yeah, they work off each other really well. And it also shows the absurdity. There's, as you said, we don't want to give away the ending on this one, but there's a gut punch of a moment that happens on stage. And
yes.
It's not a question of, will they win the competition? It's something else that, mm-hmm. you know, seasoned old folks like us went, oh, my God, they're going to go down this path. You know, the kid got into a car accident and still made it on time, or made it to a competition, albeit late. But that's what some people will do in order to be the very best. There's a there's a chilling line that Simmons' character says, the two scariest words in the English language are good job.
Yeah.
And there are people that feel that way, even today. Yeah, it's riveting stuff. It's not for everybody. It's not for the squeamish, I think. It's,
no.
You know, I use the analogy, if Lars von Trier directed Fame, or if you mixed the first half of Full Metal Jacket with Black Swan, or I think somebody wrote Full Metal Juilliard, that's what this film is like.
And I wasn't looking forward to the experience. I mean, I've been a bully. I've been bullied. I didn't want to go watch that, you know, but wow. Wow! Wow!
Yeah, and I think it's J.K. Simmons and the rest of the field. He's that good. You know, I think you said, you know, he played a white supremacist on Oz, and he was more sympathetic than the guy in Whiplash.
Oh, it's amazing work.
Great work. So go check that out. Your
top five, Matt. What are they?
Well, I'll give you my 10 because I'm the host, and you've already mentioned a few of these. Number 10 for me was Guardians of the Galaxy. Number 9 was The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
The most exciting film about decoding, but it's more than that.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, really smart script. Really good performances. Number 8, I did a tie because it's my list, and it's the two documentaries that aren't Life Itself that I really enjoyed. Tim's Vermeer and Jodorowsky's Dune.
They're both good ones, really good ones.
And these were ones that Ed and I saw in the summer. So you hear people say, well, was it a good summer? Was it a bad summer? This year was an exceptionally good summer because of the blockbuster movies. Because I really liked Guardians, I really liked Fault in Our Stars, and I really liked Godzilla.
Dawn of
the Planet of the Apes. And on the flip side, we had these small films like Tim's Vermeer, which is, again, a film about a guy who's recreating a classic painting by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes months, if not longer. And we see the process.
And he's trying to make a point. I mean, he's trying to prove something, too.
And we heard the cliche. We were on the edge of our seats, especially if he misses a brushstroke.
Mm-hmm.
It's shot that well. And Jodorowsky's Dune was about Alejandro Jodorowsky, the avant-garde Mexican filmmaker, who tried to make a movie version of Dune in the 1970s. And he had the casting, and he had the soundtrack by Pink Floyd, and people like Mick Jagger, Gloria Swanson,
Queen,
David Carradine were all involved, and the finances fell through. But here is a guy who just made his first film in, I think, 20 years, tell you the story of a film that he wasn't able to make with such passion and so excited. I said originally he should live with a man on wire guy. And he had this incredible book. He storyboarded everything. And it's one of the great what could have beens. But watching him talk about the film being made that didn't was really exciting. Number 7 was Gone Girl. My date film of the year with David Fincher, a couple that were really made for each other, really good performances by Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike.
Thriller.
It is a thriller, and I didn't read the book, so I didn't see the second half coming.
No, me neither.
It's really good.
Yeah.
That was number 7. Number 6 is another one that we saw this summer and really liked called Lock.
Oh, yeah.
With Tom Hardy.
That's 7 on my list.
Yes, Tom Hardy in a car for 90 minutes, and it's him driving to the hospital because his mistress is having a baby. His multi-million dollar construction project is falling through the tubes, as is his marriage, and it's him in a car. And it's Tom Hardy, one of the best actors working today.
And it doesn't feel like it's a gimmick, certainly, but it doesn't feel like a gimmick. It's
right.
If we say,
and we did, Tom Hardy in a car, but it's more than that. And the fact that the outside world is not used as an obstacle. It's just him and his emotions. And it looked like Tom Hardy put on weight for this. He's one of those guys, he's allowed to do that without being pretentious. That's number 6. Number 5 for me was Grand Budapest Hotel. Number 4 was Wild with Reese Witherspoon. Another one, if you said Reese Witherspoon walking, but it's more than that.
Yeah.
It's a woman who has hit rock bottom. She's lost her mother. She's had some bad lifestyle choices, and she's decided to walk up the Pacific Coast Trail 1,000 miles in order to get her life back in order. And it's an emotionally and physically grueling performance from Reese Witherspoon, and she's got it in her. I think this is my favorite work of hers.
And she doesn't play, you know, Matt described the you know the horrible life that she'd experienced. She doesn't play it that way. You see this chirpy, overprepared, and underprepared
at the same time,
person.
Really.
And it's in flashbacks over the course of the film. You get to know her that way, and you understand her character that way. But she doesn't go for melodrama. She just is very nicely done, and some of her very best work.
Yeah, and there are moments as she is going down the path, and it's not. There are moments where she's talking to herself, not all, which because that was you could have 2 hours of inner monologue, which would be fine in 1968, but not now. And her encounters with people on the trail. There's a couple moments, especially, I think we were all kind of wincing that it was going to go down a certain path, and it dangles it in front of you, it teases you a little bit, and then it goes on.
Yeah.
A really smart script. And it was from the director of Dallas Buyers Club. But yeah, really, really fine work. And this was, again, this is one I didn't see. I didn't think I was going to like it that much, and I did. Number three for me was Whiplash.
Mm-hmm.
Just drag people to it. Whether it's, I know there's a lot of people that don't like to go to the movies to squirm. Go squirm. Let them. Yeah. Or as Maurice Sendak said, let them wet their pants. Number two for me was Boyhood, and number one was Life Itself.
Wow.
And all three of those. Now, Life Itself we saw, I think, in like May. Boyhood was early, like I don't know, midsummer if I remember right, or something. But probably the middle part of the year. And still thinking about it. And Whiplash, we've just been, I remember walking out of the theater and we were just kind of buzzing with about sharing this with people.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, a little background. When the IFJA, when we critics get together for screenings, we don't always get together and huddle up and see what we think. Sometimes we kind of, if we're really strong about a film, whether it's really good or really bad, we tend to look at each other to see if somebody has the same kind of vibe about the film as we do. And we walked out of Whiplash excited.
And rattled.
Rattled at the same time about, did that just happen? Did we see this? When is it coming? We got to tell people about it. And Whiplash accomplished that. And for me, as I think Boyhood and Life Itself and the others did. So kudos to them on that. So I know Wild is still in theaters. Imitation Game is still in theaters. Whiplash, is it out? Yes, it's still in theaters. St. Vincent, which is another. That's the other thing is when I look at my what didn't make the list, what made, I guess we would call it the honorable mention, films like St. Vincent, Cavalry, The Drop, Foxcatcher, which we'll get to in a little bit, The Homesman, The Babadook. Chef, and they didn't make the top 10. That's a pretty strong list.
Snowpiercer.
So all of those, again, worth checking out. Now, Ed, we were talking off air about Foxcatcher, which opened last week. And actually, by the way, as far as last week's show, I guess I owe an apology to director Angelina Jolie. When we were on the show last week, we talked about there were a number of films opening Christmas Day, films like Big Eyes and The Gambler and others, and Into the Woods. And I said that nobody was going to go see Unbroken. And not only was it the number two film opening weekend behind The Hobbit, but it was the number one new film that opened last weekend. So I stand corrected. I shouldn't try to study box office receipts. That's not my job. So there.
All right.
That being said, there was something that just happened recently online about Foxcatcher. This is Steve Carell, Channing Tatum, Mark Ruffalo, true story of two brothers who are part of the U.S. Olympic wrestling team.
Mark and Dave Schultz.
Who wind up in the compound of billionaire, I think, John DuPont, played by Steve Carell. And they live there. They train there. Are they prisoners there? Not really, but we're not quite sure what the relationship is between the financier and the wrestlers, but there's some relationship of some kind, and you can guess. We can't.
Mostly, we're not sure what's going on in DuPont's head.
Right, and that leads to a very bad moment in the last scene of the film, based on a true story.
Boy, howdy.
Boy, howdy is right. And really good performances from the three. Bennett Miller, who directed Capote, and Moneyball does it. And it's an unnerving 2 hours and 15 minutes of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And when it drops hard.
Oh, my God.
So, and there was something about, there was a Twitter war that you were telling me about.
Yeah, Mark Schultz, Channing Tatum's character, was very supportive of the film until a couple days ago when he had a tantrum online. Some of it is still up. If you go to Facebook, type in Mark Schultz, and you'll see one with a photo and one that doesn't have a photo. He's the one that doesn't have a photo. And you can read what he left up. He took some of it down, a lot of it down. He objected. Basically, what it boils down to is there's a scene in the film that he thought made it look like there could possibly have been a sexual relationship between him and DuPont. He talked to the writer or the director. I don't know which one.
Okay.
But he talked to him and said, and voiced that, and they said, no, no, it's just, this is part of, and they explained how it was just part of a bigger picture they were working on. Then he read some reviewers or some stuff online where people were speculating whether they had a sexual relationship, and he, you know, he felt outraged because that scene that he tried to get removed, he thought had done exactly what he feared it would do. Fueled speculation of something that he said was not only ridiculous, it was sickening with this guy, you know. And he explains himself very clearly, but then he went on to post things like talking about the director. I hate him. 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 Hate, 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 hate. I hate him. I hate him. I hate him.
So the tweets of a middle schooler.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and it's like he made clear in his tweet complaining about the, or his Facebook post complaining about the film, that the film makes it look like he's looking for a father figure or a mentor, but really he wasn't at all, and he explains why. Then he does this tantrum that makes it look like he makes him sound like a little boy looking for a father figure, you know. So it's really weird. Like I said, read it yourself. Mark Schultz, you can find him on Facebook. I don't know what's on Twitter. I didn't check.
And I'm sure the items that were taken down, I'm sure somebody got a hold of it and visual, and you could find images of it somewhere.
And most of the stuff taken down was just the repeated I hate yous and a kind of veiled threat to beat the guy up and stuff like that.
Well, he's a wrestler.
Yeah. Yeah, none of which makes the film any less fascinating.
No,
I mean,
it is.
Wow.
And what Ed's talking about is, it's a possibility. It doesn't say, you know, why the idea of an eccentric billionaire offering you free room and board to train for months on end, if not longer, and then to, you know, you're basically living there. It's, you know, I guess take stock in your own self on how you would handle a situation like that.
People, you know, because part of the thing with the film is that in real life, if you remember the news story, we didn't find out, we've not to this day found out what was going on in John DuPont's head. So the film was thoughtful enough to stick to that. So you're left to speculate on what were the motivations, what was this guy thinking about. Given that they make sure that they don't draw conclusions for you, when you see this much older guy hanging around and putting a great deal of money into a bunch of very physically fit, young, strapping young men, the sexual thing is something you think about. You just can't help but think about that, along with many, many other possibilities.
Yeah,
many.
There is a competition, you know, not a rivalry, but there's almost a battle between the Carell character and the Mark Ruffalo character, because one is a brother and the other is a friend, a financier, a father figure, even though he doesn't want to admit it. There's a scene where the Carell character, where John DuPont visits the cabin at 3 a.m. There's a scene where John DuPont's mother, a fun cameo by Vanessa Redgrave, who shows up and doesn't care in the least of what her son is doing.
She doesn't like low sports.
Right. There are moments But they don't go any further than that, and you have to draw your own conclusion to what leads to a bit of a wallop at the end of the film.
Yeah.
So be aware of that. But yeah, you should go see that as well.
And we have, along with this, we have other controversies. Selma, which is coming up. When that opens, you know, we can all...
I think that's next week.
But there's a controversy right now on the depiction of Lyndon Baines Johnson and whether they made him more of a, kind of tried to make him into a villain to make the film more dramatically interesting.
Well, last time we saw Lyndon B. Johnson in a film, he was sitting on the toilet in Lee Daniels' The Butler. So it's got to hopefully be a little more up than that. And besides, it's played by Tom Wilkinson. I got a feeling Wilkinson's going to make the most out of the material he's given, regardless mm-hmm. of how he is portrayed. Wilkinson's a smart actor, so we'll see about that next week.
Yeah, and with The Imitation Game, with all the films based on true stories, there are currently people complaining about the parts of inaccuracies in the film, and all the complaints are coming the same week the Oscar ballots went out. So. Some folks with an agenda have waited their time.
Right. And I think if a film like this, if a biopic makes you go as soon as you see it, and by the way, you got to see it. If you see it and then go do the research on what, is this right? Is this isn't right? How is this altered? How is this changed? Then the film has done its job.
Yeah.
So, and then you can post online for whatever. So
there's one called American Sniper coming up.
With that's right, directed by Clint Eastwood with Bradley Cooper.
I went straight home and started reading up.
Did you?
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah? How, can you tell us how it went?
A lot of it was right. I mean, the important stuff was right.
Cool. You know what? We're going to take a short break because we have a special guest in studio. Stick around. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Matthew Sosi here, hanging out with Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, and joining us in studio, Happy New Year, Kobe Slagle.
Happy New Year, everybody.
How are you?
Good. Yourself?
We're doing well. We're Good. Doing well. Now, you're young. You were able to stay up till midnight.
Yes.
And then, like, 12:01, go straight to sleep.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's okay.
All the countdown shows are on till like 3 or 4 in the morning.
Nobody
to
needs
accommodate.
That.
Yeah, to accommodate the West Coast and all this, and yeah, no.
So I guess
you're not supposed to be on watching television. You're young. You should have been down at Radio with me and my son watching the Roy Orbison tribute, The Last Four, and Creepin' Charlie and the Night Cats or whatever they're called.
Creepin' Charlie.
Creepin' Charlie.
Not Little Charlie. That's a different band, but
it was great. It was a great show, great evening. You should have been there. We partied like it was 1999.
How'd you feel the next afternoon?
Well, that turned out to be my cholesterol count.
Okay. So yeah,
God, I'm doing shtick.
You are doing shtick. You know what? It is? Pledge dollars at work, right here. All right. By the way, have you seen anything since we last saw you? It's been a week. There's you have no excuses except for the holidays.
Yes, Ed saw Big Eyes.
What'd you think of that?
Liked it, not loved it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a nice way to spend an hour and 45 minutes with you know, people you don't hate.
Are you quoting Ed's bits now?
No, I'm quoting Mike Perry.
Oh, I see.
But as I was trying to, remember the film that you broke down last week, and
that was Big Eyes.
Yeah, and then I remembered as I was in. Oh yes, Big Eyes and the paint. Yes, so.
So you enjoyed
your,
it.
Your analysis was spot on.
Oh, good. someone from his family, Walter Keane's family, is challenging the film's accuracy, saying it's based on her book and doesn't tell the true story of Walter, that he was really an artist and his name is being defamed right now.
The bits at the end about, you know, the where they are now type things that they uh-huh. always do on these documentary type things. That was incredible.
I know.
Yeah.
Yep.
I know.
That's unreal. You saw it too?
I did see it. My big thing was it was nice for Tim Burton and Johnny Depp to take a break from each other.
Oh, it was nice for me just to not see Johnny Depp.
Yes. But it was I compared it to Ed Wood, and it has the same writers that worked with Burton on Ed Wood,
uh-huh.
where it is treating the artist just for who the artist is. Didn't try to make her as the greatest painter since Rembrandt. She, you know, just like he didn't try to treat Ed Wood like he was John Ford. Just really enjoyed the material, enjoyed the story of the artist, really liked Amy Adams, really liked Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
He, you know what he does? He does Christoph Waltz things.
Yes, Christoph Waltz bad guy things.
Bad guy things where he is charming and nice, and then he's got a mean streak at the most opportune moments. So, yeah, it was a nice...
Have we seen a movie where Christoph Waltz is a nice guy?
Carnage? No.
No.
Django?
Django? Yeah, but well, if you okay. think about it, he is nicest
yeah.
in Django.
He's a good guy in Django.
No, I think since the Christoph Waltz Renaissance, which means the Americans know who he is, I don't think so. We'll have to, you know what? Go on to IMDb and check out Mr. Waltz's page. He was the best thing about the Green Hornet. Does that make him nice?
No.
I don't know. I never saw it.
No.
That's okay.
Can we talk about Johnny Depp for a second?
Into the Woods?
No, just in general, because Ed was talking about how it's good to just not see Johnny Depp.
Do you feel like an old person when you're just saying, you know what, can you just play a normal-looking person? Can you stop with the freak makeup and just play somebody regular?
Former hugest thing in the world, Johnny Depp.
Wow, look at the snark coming from Cobe.
What happened?
He's got an island to maintain, doesn't he?
He lives in France, man.
And he lives in France. And he's got an island in France.
You know... He lives in France.
He lives in France, and he's on Tim Burton's speed dial.
And every bit of quirkiness he has is fully indulged and celebrated.
Yeah.
Even if it's Dark Shadows. So,
oh, I forgot about that.
We didn't.
He's the Michael Jackson of acting.
Except Joe Jackson didn't beat him in the head as a child.
I want to.
So,
but do we dislike Johnny Depp because... We dislike Johnny Depp. Do we dislike Johnny Depp because of his recent choices? Do we dislike Johnny Depp because he's everywhere and seems to play the same character all the time?
The last two.
Yeah, I dislike Depp's choices. I think I'm sure he's a fine individual.
Yeah, and a good actor when somebody hits him with a cardboard tube.
That's your term. Yeah,
you know, enough to get his attention, but not to hurt him.
Yeah. So you know, the guy's received nominations before and well deserved. But it sounds like he needs a challenge and not just getting a $20 million check to do Pirates 5.
He needs to play a down-to-earth person with an accent that he grew up having, you know, and
regular clothes.
And regular clothes with a really strong script.
Yeah. And not make a lot of money off of it. You know, do the old, you do one for the studio, you do one for yourself.
This
he kind of owes us five.
Yeah, this one is retribution.
Yeah, so that's just kind of tired of what he's doing right now.
So we are not looking, the consensus of film sociology is that we are not looking forward to Mordecai.
No.
No, that's released in January for a reason.
A George Lucas film with Johnny Depp released in January.
And it's a spy film.
It's a George Lucas film.
Yeah.
Is that the one?
It's a production company, right?
I saw something that said George Lucas that
presents,
was an animated thing.
You better look. Look at that up, Kobe. But also a spy spoof in 2015.
Mm.
a genre that has been spoofed three times by one comic actor already, what new could you bring to the table? I like Paul Bettany. I like Gwyneth. But again, this is released. There are films that are released in January and August for a reason. This is one of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know we haven't seen it yet. We will. We'll get to it.
Sometimes you've seen the film before you see it. I mean, the studio will tip you off. You know, if they don't do a screening for critics, or if they screen it the night before it opens,
10 o'clock Thursday night.
Yeah, they're telling you something. You know, they're letting you know right ahead. You know.
And speaking of which, I always have to give, this is my annual give thanks to Ed, to you, sir, because for years I used to do a worst 10, and then you helped make me realize I don't have to. You don't do a worst 10. You don't even do a worst 5.
No.
You do.
Most annoying.
An annoying 5, because there are times, yes, I use the term I see films so you don't have to, but there are certain weeks you're like, well, could I see this big, loud, budgeted monstrosity, or do I want to see a film that I really want to talk about on the show?
Yeah.
And you opt for the latter. So these are not the worst films of the year. These are the worst films I got to see this year. Ed, what's on your annoying 5?
Hercules. I'll throw that.
Which one?
The Dwayne Johnson one.
Really?
Because.
Wait, what was the other one?
It was one that was released in January that had
somebody we never heard of,
right? Yeah. Some Euro actor that look great, chiseled, but that's about it.
My problem with Hercules is just Hercules as a concept works pretty
well. The
Legend
of Hercules.
That was the other one.
That's the Dwayne Johnson. Okay.
That's the other,
the non Dwayne Johnson one. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that came out almost last year.
But the Dwayne Johnson one, the people behind the film decided that the story of Hercules wasn't quite interesting enough on its own. So what if what people believed about Hercules wasn't really true, and these guys were kind of frauds? Merry guys going around the countryside tricking people.
So it was Dragonheart? Who cares?
Who cares? Who cares? That was the whole thing.
Wow.
Directed
by Brett Ratner. The way to go.
Yeah, Brett, and he's done so much good work.
Yeah.
Sin City, A Dame to Kill For.
Yeah, I really like the first one, and that second one really wasn't needed.
I'm real proud of my summary line, too.
Yes, sir.
The first one was striking. This one is stricken.
Nice.
Transformers, Age of Extinction.
You sat through that.
What's Mark Wahlberg doing in this junk? He's just hurting himself.
He got an incredible amount of money, and apparently his small film for himself was The Gambler, which I don't know anybody who has seen.
No.
So, wow. Okay.
Left Behind.
Well, that's coming out on DVD next week.
Nicolas Cage doing a reboot of a Kirk Cameron film. Now, let's think about that for just a second. Nicolas Cage. Remember when Nicolas Cage was Nicolas Cage? Now he's the new version of Kirk Cameron.
Is this a film, because I always say this, the next Nicolas Cage project, and I have to determine if he is or isn't trying to pay off the debt that he owes because of his bad management.
There's no money in this.
So this is one he did on it, because he worked with Werner Herzog, and he did a film called Joe, which I know a lot of folks liked, but this one, it sounds like no check.
And Left Behind is a Christian film for the kind of Christians that got hit in the back of the head with a piece of lumber a few minutes ago, and they're just starting to come around.
Oh, boy.
That's the movie.
Uh-huh.
Number one, A Million Ways to Die in the West. They were talking comedically.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That also made my 5 that I had to sit through. Thanks, Seth.
If you're Seth Farland, a fan of his animated shows, has anyone on any of the animated shows made fun of that movie yet? Because that would really be appropriate.
No, and he's not going to host the Oscars again to make fun of it either.
I don't think he's going to get to host anything.
Anything. So
I hope not.
That's, A Million Ways to Die in the West is on mine. Speaking of Christian finance films, The Identical was one of my favorite get drunk and watch bad films. It almost could be The Room, Cobe. It takes the story of what if, now for those who don't know, and apparently some don't, Elvis Presley had a twin brother who died at childbirth.
Yeah.
somebody took the idea of what would happen if the twin lived. Now, it's not a film about Elvis, but it's one of them becomes the son of a preacher man, another Dusty Springfield tunes. One is given up for adoption to a preacher played by Ray Liotta and his wife played by Ashley Judd. So he becomes a preacher's kid. The other one becomes a rock and roller, but it's not Elvis. And he does movies in the 60s set on beaches, but it's not Elvis. And
is he good or is he evil?
No, he's not. It's not an evil, good evil thing, but it's what happens if these two lives intertwine. One who is an Elvis-like character and one who is always told he looks and sounds like the Elvis-type character.
And what's the Christian factor of the film?
It's financed by that, and there's a big pro-Israel message in the picture itself. And it opened in like 20 screens. So, yeah, I saw this. And of course, it's a film that while there's scenes in the 60s and 70s, nobody looks, nobody sounds anything like the 60s and 70s when it comes to production value.
Okay.
It's a 12-pack movie. Have a 12-pack and enjoy that.
Or better yet, find a good movie
and watch
enjoy
that instead.
That.
Because you didn't have to sit through I, Frankenstein.
No.
I sat through that with Aaron Eckhart. Not him personally. He was on the film. the latest filming of Adam Sandler's Summer Vacation that was known as Blended.
You didn't like that?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. Because this is the third pairing between Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. And they are usually in, like, they were.
Others being 50 First Dates
and
The
Wedding Singer. And
I like them
they're both the
together.
Best part about that, of those films. And in this one, it is, of course, they hate each other at the beginning. They don't like each other. Benedict and Beatrice can see this coming. And the fact that she even starts to do Sandler-like slapstick, and it looks embarrassing as opposed to funny. And they shot his Vacation.
And I'll tell you what, I ran into Drew Barrymore once. I mean, ran into Drew Barrymore. We were coming into the same room from different directions, and I mean, like the meet cute romantic thing. We banged into each other and dropped the stuff, and I'm helping to pick up her stuff and stuff. It was a very short encounter, but I'll tell you what, she was the sunniest, sweetest human being I've ever met. It was, it wasn't because she was Drew Barrymore. It was because
it just happened.
It was her. It was just, I felt better just being in her presence, and I'm not starstruck, you know?
Right.
She just has a quality that's amazing. You know, I've never forgotten how I felt just hanging around her for 30 seconds. You know, just the sweetest.
And the other film I had to sit through was Sex Tape.
Oh.
With Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm 45, and I'm tired of films that have people, characters my age, complaining that they're not young and hip anymore. It happened with Neighbors. It happens in Knocked Up. You grow old. There's nothing you can do about it. Deal with it.
And don't inflict it on everybody else.
Please. Please do. And This Is 40. I hated This Is 40 with a fiery passion. So, at one point, an idea of a sex tape with Cameron Diaz would be a good idea, and we've already seen Jason Segel naked. This is one of those films where you have smart people who get absolutely country dumb when it comes to technology. Like, you know, being able to erase things, being able to transfer things, and then you get into a bunch of sub-1980s wacky scenarios to try to get the sex tape off the internet. Just dumb. Really sad. So don't see those films. We did. So we're going to shift gears a little bit. There's only two titles on DVD and Blu-ray this week.
Uh-huh.
One is The Equalizer.
Okay. That's a fun movie, kind of.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Nobody has to worry about it's not going to overshadow the 80s TV series. It's another action film with Denzel. And of course, from the people at Sony, it's the president's favorite movie.
Well, it's good action, and Denzel is Denzel. I mean, I like watching
Speaking
Denzel
of
do that.
That
stuff.
Man needs to do a comedy really soon.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not fair that he's not allowed to do comedy. And of course, the CEOs from Sony have emails that say he won't.
I'd like to see him in a Wes Anderson.
You're talking about Denzel?
Yeah,
he needs to do. Last comedy I think he did was The Preacher's Wife. That's almost 20 years ago.
Similar to Johnny Depp here. Do we want to see Denzel do other stuff?
Yeah, I'd like to
it
see him
nice.
Do non-action movies.
Are we tired of Denzel doing Denzel things?
Well, he's still pulling it off, but, I mean, you know he's capable of doing way more, and it'd be nice to see him just do some of the other stuff, too.
Yeah, and the last third of this film, which happened, the climax happens in a warehouse store
uh-huh.
that's not anything we've seen before. But, you know, it is... I think there is a shot where the fire alarm goes off and the sprinklers happen and there's people walking in slow motion in the sprinkler rain, and you've seen that.
I like watching the movie, though. It was a fun. I had fun.
And the other one is the not perfect but must be talked about Kevin Smith film Tusk.
Wow. Did you see that one?
It's basically Kevin Smith making a film based on a dare that happened on his podcast or Smodcast.
Michael Parks. If you remember him, you probably don't.
The sheriff from Dusk Till Dawn, the sheriff from Kill Bill.
He was
classic that guy.
He plays a nut job who is obsessed with walruses. And I don't know. I think it's safe to give this away.
He wants to turn people into walruses, and he gets a smart aleck podcast guy played by Justin Long, and it's the kind of dumb person or dumb teenagers walking into a scary movie.
And you know how Justin Long, how annoying he can be.
Yeah.
Well, you get to see him turned into a walrus. So, right there, you know.
So you've seen these, you know, like the dumb teenagers in the van going to, you know, whether it's Tourist Trap or Friday the 13th, or it's those types of films where dumb kids waiting to be killed. In this case, it's one person. And it's not perfect. Johnny Depp is in this, and he's not fun.
No.
And they're going to branch off of this with him. But all that being said, Michael Parks is the best thing about the film. As ridiculous as this film concept sounds, and we hear you laughing, Cobe, he really sells it. Parks is the best thing about
good.
The film. So good for him to check that out.
Okay, the convenience store scene. When you see the two girls in the convenience store, it's Johnny Depp's daughter and Kevin Smith's daughter, and the next movie Kevin Smith makes is going to be those two girls playing those two characters.
And hopefully without Johnny Depp involved.
Better not be.
So, all right, we have time for Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like.
Nope.
Louise Rainer, who died at the age of 104, and this is one for you trivia nerds out there. She won back-to-back Best Actress Oscars in 1936 and 1937.
Wow.
For The Great Ziegfeld and for The Good Earth. So, and it's Rainer on that.
So the first film was great and the second one was good.
Those were the titles.
Wow. One can only imagine what the title would have been the following
the
year.
The Mediocre Plains.
Yes.
Christine.
The So-So Monsoon.
Exactly. Mostly known as voice actress Christine Cavanaugh, died at the age of 51. Say what you will, anything else. In our house, she's the voice of Babe from 1995. I know she was also a voice on Rugrats as Chucky, and the other one that's big around the house, she was the voice of Dexter in Dexter's Laboratory.
She was Chucky's voice?
Yeah.
Oh, poor. Oh.
See? So you can go out. She's done TV. She's done movies. But those are the best things she's known for. And I found out there's a documentary called I Know That Voice, which
yes.
is about cartoon voice artists.
Great documentary.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yes.
Oh, Emma and I, we're going to go check that out. So what I didn't know, she was not
I believe she's in that.
She is. She is not the voice of Babe in the sequel, Babe Pig in the City, which I did not know. So there is that.
Babe 2, still Babe.
Still pigging. And more known for TV, but I have to mention the movie. And we did. Edward Herman passed away at the age of 71.
And the headlines are saying,
Gilmore Girl.
Gilmore Girl star dies.
Don't call him that.
That's wrong.
That's the man. First off, he's known for other things. But he
like
played
the Lost Boys.
Yeah, Lost Boys, Nelson Rockefeller, and Nixon. Did a TV movie of Eleanor and Franklin. where he mm-hmm. played Franklin Roosevelt,
which terrific.
Opposite of Jane Alexander, and they did another one in 1982. And for, of course, here at PBS Land, he was also a voice in the Ken Burns documentary, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. Uh-huh. And he was also one of those guys, he was like born 40, even in his early yeah. films like The Paper Chase. He was in the 70s version of The Great Gatsby. He was in Reds, Purple Rose of Cairo, Overboard, and The Emperor's Club. And then Donna Douglas, yes, Ellie Mae.
Ellie Mae died?
81 years old from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh.
But she was also known as Peter's secretary in Lover Come Back with Rock Hudson. And she was Frankie in the Elvis vehicle Frankie and Johnny from 1966.
When did she die?
Today.
Oh, poor, well, that's a
81.
Shame.
81. 81. So we will raise our rope belt to Ellie Mae at the Cement Pond. All right, we have words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
We don't do resolutions here, but somebody should get Ed Johnsonaut a Zardoz belt buckle for 2015. Ed, thanks for hanging out. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. You have no excuse. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
We go. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.
Good night, IMA.